What it means to pull a Mulan. Today, Wednesday, January 28th, this is The World. I'm Carol Hills, and for Marco Werman, a young woman recruited by ISIS wishes she could disguise herself as a man so she could fight. Other recruits are seduced by romance.
This is a sense of adventure. Many of them have never traveled by themselves. They've been recruited and told that they will be traveling to a faraway place where they will marry this romantic idea of a jihadist soldier out in the desert.
Also today, life in a Liberian Ebola ward.
You stand in line and you wait and you get your temperature taken, you wash your hands, you get your feet sprayed.
Plus a Cuban artist, released but not free.
They took my passport. I can go out of my house, but I'm followed 24/7.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and for Marco Werman, and this is The World. From its brutal attacks on the ground in Iraq and Syria to its recruiting of young people in the West, the extremist group ISIS is almost constantly in the news. But most of all, it's hard to think of ISIS without thinking of the hostages they've killed and the ones they still hold. And at the center of the latest drama are two hostages, an Air Force pilot from Jordan and a freelance journalist from Japan, both of whom ISIS has threatened to kill. Derek Stoffel is in Amman, CBC News. Jordan seems to be willing to actually make a deal with ISIS to get one of its hostages released. What is that deal?
Well, Jordan is prepared to release an Iraqi woman who is being held here. She was convicted in her role in a suicide bombing 10 years ago here in Amman. She was originally given the death penalty, but that was commuted to life in prison. And ever since the Jordanian pilot, his name is First Lieutenant Muath Kisabe, when his plane crashed back in December, this whole country has been transfixed by his faith. There's been really growing pressure on King Abdullah to do anything, really, as in the words of the pilot's father. He said that last night, Jordan must do anything to get my son released. And it does appear the Jordanians are listening, because I think it was a bit surprising when they came out and said that, yes, we are prepared to release this Iraqi woman in exchange for the pilot. Now, that was several hours ago, and the Jordanian foreign minister is saying that, well, yes, we've been in touch with ISIS. We asked for proof the pilot is still alive, and they haven't heard anything back.
Doesn't Jordan have a policy of not negotiating with ISIS?
No, it is a bit different here in the Middle East and with Jordan, even though that they are a member of the American-led coalition, the countries that are launching bombing raids on ISIS in Iraq and Syria. So I think what we're really seeing here is the government reacting to a situation that could, you know, quickly get out of hand. Already today in the pilot's hometown, there were people out on the streets pushing for his release. There is growing sentiment here that the anti-ISIS mission is unpopular. People are asking why they're, you know, launching these bombing raids. And so it seems that Jordan's King Abdullah is responding. You know, just tonight he met with the mother and father of the pilot. So that speaks to the fact that he doesn't want this situation to get out of hand.
I want to now switch to the Japanese hostage. What is the latest?
Freelance journalist Kenji Goto. This moment, we believe him to still be alive. There was a video that purports to be Kenji Goto, in which he said yesterday at around 4 p.m. local time here in Amman, he said, I've got 24 hours to live, and the pilot even less. So, of course, that deadline has come and passed, and we haven't heard anything as to what is the situation with Kenji Goto. But things certainly got muddled here today, Carol, with the announcement from the Jordanians that, yes, they were willing to offer the release of the Iraqi woman for their pilot, because now that had everyone asking, you know, I was standing outside the Jordanian embassy where there's a top-level Japanese official in town doing the negotiating. So what does this mean for Japan? Now that the Jordanians are saying, we'll release this woman, what does it mean for the Japanese hostage? And no one, I spoke to a couple of officials at the Japanese embassy, and they would not answer that question. It seems that is the big question from the Japanese side. What does the Jordanian move mean for the Japanese hostage?
Where does that leave things, Derek? It sounds like officials don't even know exactly where these two hostages are. Is that true?
Certainly. We don't know, are they being held together? In that still photo released yesterday, Kenji Goto was shown holding a picture of the Jordanian pilot. So it did not appear at that stage that they were together. Perhaps ISIS keeping them apart to make sure that if there is a raid, both aren't freed. So certainly here in Jordan, a lot of anxious people. And I do know in the same situation is true, lots of anxiety in Japan where people are actually holding vigils outside of government offices.
Do we know that they're both even in Syria, or is it not even clear whether they're in Syria or in Iraq?
Not clear where they are.
The CBC's Derek Stoffel speaking to us from Amman. In Syria, ISIS suffered a major battlefield defeat yesterday. Kurdish fighters and Western air power finally pushed the group's militants out of the besieged city of Kobani. Robin Wright wrote about the battle's significance in a recent New Yorker article.
Kobani is actually a fairly small town of only 40,000 people, but it is located right on the border of Turkey. Turkey is an important Western and NATO ally, and that has brought the Islamic State right up to the borderline with the West. So it's important more symbolically than it is in terms of its strategic value.
And how were ISIS militants forced out of the city?
ISIS was forced out after a four-month campaign by both tough Kurdish fighters on the ground using vintage weaponry, often fighting room to room, house to house, but also backed up by one of the most powerful air coalitions in recent history. You had Europeans, Arabs, and the United States all involved in pounding the city daily. I've been at that war front, standing on the hill looking at this battlefront, and you feel the reverberations of these powerful bombs hitting little Kobani. It is clear that the Kurds could never have recaptured their town unless the West had become involved in Operation Inherent Resolve.
Now, you mentioned you've been to the city. What do people think of ISIS there? I mean, are they glad that they're gone?
Well, the militia itself put out a statement saying that this was a war between humanity and barbarity. And there are lots of differences, whether it comes to politics, religion, ethnicity. This is much more than just a territorial dispute. But Kobani, in many ways, was also an aberration from the two different wars that are playing out in Syria. And it does not mark the beginning of the end for ISIS. ISIS lost a very large number of fighters, somewhere close to 2,000, according to the Pentagon. But it was not going to change the dynamics of their hold on a huge area of both Syria and Iraq that is equal to about twice the size of Massachusetts. That territorial hold, that sweep, and that momentum has not changed. But ISIS has been contained for the time being. It has not taken significant amounts of territory in recent months.
Does this victory in Kobani, does it mean that the same tactics should be used in other parts of ISIS-controlled territory in Syria?
Well, the question is not only whether it should be used elsewhere, but whether it's even viable. The United States spent hundreds of millions of dollars in freeing little Kobani and allowing 40,000 people to at some point eventually to return home. The city's in ruins at the moment. But can that be a model in terms of either cost or intensity elsewhere in Syria, which has 22 million people, or elsewhere in Iraq? Now, the United States has already said that this is a years-long campaign, and it has committed to using its air power, but it has to find viable troops on the ground, effectively the role the Kurdish fighters played, in order to win back territory. So this is a very slow-moving campaign. Kobani may prove to be an aberration for the time being.
So can you really call the defeat in Kobani a victory?
Well, it is a victory in some ways and not in others. It is a victory for those who live in Kobani, but it doesn't change the realities on the ground in terms of the territorial hold by ISIS or the future of the campaign. This was, in many ways, a symbolic battlefront that came to represent American military might in the air versus the jihadi onslaught on the ground. And the confluence of factors came together in Kobani. They have not yet come together in other parts of either Syria or Iraq.
That was journalist and writer Robin Wright. In both Iraq and Syria, ISIS has targeted Kurdish communities, and Kurds have taken a leading role in fighting back. But some young Kurdish men have actually taken the opposite stance. They've joined ISIS and are now fighting against their own people. Rebecca Collard has that story from Erbil.
When a truck blew up in front of Erbil's governorate building in November, many here wondered how a vehicle loaded with explosives managed to get past all the checkpoints and into the Kurds' de facto capital. A few days later, they got their answer. ISIS claimed the attack, saying it was one of their Kurdish recruits that carried out the bombing. The TV news blared reports of a man ISIS identified as Abdel Rahman al-Kurdi, who committed the attack with two other operatives. Hundreds of Kurds have crossed the front line to join ISIS, essentially to join the fight to kill Kurds. It's shocking to many here, but the Kurds are Sunni Muslims, like ISIS. And like disaffected, searching young men from across the Muslim world, they too can be seduced. Salam Sidan works with the Kurdish government's Ministry of Religion. He says it's hard to know how many Kurds have joined ISIS. Some simply disappear. Others let their families know what they've done. But there's a group that posts their pictures on Facebook, talk about their exploits, and shows up in videos like this one. A man stands with a group of militants in front of the infamous black and white ISIS flag and threatens what he calls his secular, misguided Kurdish brethren. With the simple guns we carry, we will come soon and take revenge for all the innocent Muslims you have killed, the man says. We will see you soon in Erbil and Sulaymaniyah, two of the Kurdish region's well-known cities. The video ends implying the man has blown himself up in a van at a Kurdish military installation. Sidan says many of these young men are recruited online, possibly with videos like this. But the Kurdish regional government also worries others might be influenced by the preaching of radical imams in Kurdish mosques, imams who are on the government payroll. One Kurdish imam who left to join ISIS was from the neighborhood of Daretu, on the edge of Erbil. It's one of the poorer parts of the city. The roads are gravel and full of potholes. On one corner, the faded green doors of the tiny Jaffer Mosque open onto the muddy streets. Residents here recall how Imam Shawin Kurdi disappeared last November. Kurdish intelligence believes he's now in Mosul, the largest city under control of the so-called Islamic State. People in this relatively small community were generally shocked, but some say there were warning signs. Ismail Osman and his friend Mohammed Jamil say they argued with Imam Shawin. They say the imam preached a much more conservative version of Islam than most Kurds follow. I asked him, "Why do you teach these things?" recalls Osman. "None of our other imams taught them." Back at the religion ministry, Sidan says his office has fired 80 government-paid religious teachers and imams they considered not modern enough to be preaching. He says they replaced them with new religious leaders that better fit with the Kurds' ideas of moderation and tolerance of others. But of course, more will join ISIS, says Sidan. It's natural. For the world, I'm Rebecca Collard, Erbil, Northern Iraq.
Coming up later in the show, what attracts young women in the West to leave home and join ISIS? That's still to come. This is The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Carol Hills with The World. The U.S. and Cuba may be in the process of normalizing their relations, but that hasn't stopped Cuba from continuing to arrest dissidents on the island. Many have been detained in recent weeks. One of them was artist Tania Bruguera, who normally splits her time between the U.S. and Cuba. After the announcement of a thaw with the United States, she planned to hold an open mic performance in Havana's Revolution Square. She wanted to give ordinary Cubans the chance to describe their vision for the island's future. But right before her performance, she was arrested. Bruguera has since been released and is still in Havana. So, Tania, what's your current legal status in Cuba? I mean, do you have your passport? What's going on?
They took my passport. I can go out of my house, but I'm followed 24/7 by a car and by people. And they have proposed to give me back my passport if I am willing to leave the country and never come back. And then I say no to that.
Now, I wondered, have you noticed any kind of thaw as we've moved toward this announcement that Cuba and the U.S. will reestablish relations? Do you think that there's more artistic freedom, or do you feel like the fact that you were detained, that it's same old, same old?
For years and years, the cultural policy has been of a soft censorship, meaning that you self-censor yourself, so you do the work for them. And you use a lot of metaphor and association, so you don't do a direct criticism. So there is this game where people are playing those boundaries. For example, let's do events, art in the street, social art, but without being social or without criticizing society. Let's do work with people. Let's do, you know, community work without making that a political critique. And the other thing in the art is now everybody's getting ready for the Cuban art boom and becoming really rich and famous. So I think people are not going to lose that possibility.
You've had your own critics, people who feel like you're kind of jumping on the dissident bandwagon and staging art installations and sort of getting in the media and getting attention, you know, when they've been toiling along all this time.
First of all, what I actually had is a lot of solidarity from the dissidents, and a lot of them have thanked me personally about that action, while at the same time, I'm not part of their groups. So I'm curious who said that, or if it's that part of the campaign of defamation the government has started, where they say at the same time that I'm CIA, at the same time they say I'm a dissident, at the same time they say they don't like me. So they are creating a lot of chaos. I have received many, many calls from people, dissidents from many, many different groups. Actually, some of them have said that I actually achieved something nobody has achieved before, which is united the whole dissidents with this action.
Tania, my final question is, do you think that you'll be able to leave and come back to Cuba as you've done in the past?
I don't know. Everything is very confusing. I have no idea. What I know is I'm not leaving Cuba for a long time because, first of all, I don't want them to trick me saying that my case is solved. I go out and then they reopen the case while I'm out and then I cannot come back. So I need to make sure I have everything legally. That's my priority right now more than exhibitions or whatever.
Tania Bruguera is a Cuban installation and performance artist. In recent weeks, Cuban authorities have arrested her 3 times. Thank you so much, Tania.
Thank you so much.
If you've ever shopped for matzah in a supermarket, you've probably seen the pink Streitz box with the red logo. Streitz Matzah is one of the world's largest producers of the Jewish Passover cracker, and it's been making matzah on New York's Lower East Side for nearly 100 years. But now the Streitz family is planning on closing down their flagship factory and leaving the neighborhood after the Passover rush. Emma Morgenstern recently paid them a visit.
The Streitz Matzah storefront carries everything from matzah to macaroons. 2 huge portraits hang on the wall, of the founder, Aaron Streit, and his wife, Nettie. And then there's the living memorial to the Streitz legacy.
My name's Aaron Gross. I'm 5th generation Streitz family member, and I run the company with myself and 2 other cousins.
Aaron Yagoda and Alan Adler. Their ancestor, Aaron Streit, was a Jewish immigrant from Austria. He opened his first small matzah bakery just a few blocks away on Pitt Street in 1916.
In 1925 is when Aaron decided to move over to Rivington Street, where we still are now, and mechanize and build the larger machine bakery that it is today.
On the day of visit, another cousin, Annie Gross, stops by the factory. And she and Yagoda reminisce a bit.
As a kid, we'd all play here. We rode the high-low, run around and stuff like that.
They would always yell at us, "Don't go up the steps!"
The Lower East Side has changed a lot over the decades, from a Jewish immigrant neighborhood known for cramped tenement houses to a fashion-conscious area known for chic restaurants and $19 million penthouses. But inside the factory, not much has changed. The massive ovens date back to the late 30s, and they've been slowing down in their old age.
They just don't retain heat like they used to, and do slow down the process a little bit.
But they can't slow down too much. The entire process of making matzah has to be done in under 18 minutes, according to Jewish law.
You walk inside, and it's just like walking into 1920s, 1930s, Lower East Side, New York City. It's gears running. There's rabbis cleaning machines on every floor. There's this buzz of people working.
That's Michael Levine, director of an upcoming documentary called Streitz Matzah and the American Dream. And it's not just the machinery that harks back to the Lower East Side of yore. There's the immigrant workforce from Poland to Mexico and Bangladesh. I spoke to one worker named Michael Abramoff, a Bukharian Jew from what's now known as Uzbekistan. He's a matzah cutter.
My cousin brings me here. It's exactly this year is going to be 26 years ago.
This is not uncommon for the factory. Michael Levine says whole families work here, fathers, sons, brothers. No women, though.
I know for some of the workers there, they're multi-generational just like the owners are. I mean, there are second and third generation workers at the factory.
Back in the cousin's office, Yagoda shows me his desk, which belonged to his grandfather, the son of Aaron Streit.
Out of respect, I never cleaned it. So everything on the desk is mine. Everything in the desk is still my grandfather's.
Yagoda pulls out some documents, a passport and a visa that belong to Nettie. He unfolds them and he starts reading.
But look how they people then. Eyes gray, nose normal, mouth proportionate, chin double. How insulting. Imagine if you like didn't like people and you were in charge of writing that down.
The factory is rich with history, but the cousins have decided it's time to leave. Aaron Gross says it's just getting too hard to keep the factory here.
If anybody was going to build a factory today, the last thing they would try to do is convert four tenement buildings and six stories and put a factory in it.
When they move, they'll update their machinery and get another luxury they don't have here, a loading dock. And based on the real estate market on the Lower East Side, they stand to turn quite a profit. But still.
We hung on longer than we actually should have, but I feel good about that. It's not like, you know, there was a leak in the boat and we all jumped ship. We waited till the boat was almost where we had to leave.
The cousins plan to bring as many of the workers as they can to the new facility in New Jersey. But they can't bring the neighborhood.
I'm going to catch up with my cousin.
For The World, I'm Emma Morgenstern, New York's Lower East Side.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. Ahead, the link between corruption and extremism and the violent language that runs inside some churches in Nigeria.
People would jump up and shake their fists, and the violence in the air, the powerful negative emotions that were being evoked and expressed. And we're talking big churches.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills and for Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The worst may be over, but the fight against Ebola in West Africa is not over. There are still new infections and deaths being registered. And health officials warn it's too early to let anyone's guard down against the disease. Over the last few months, we've been checking in with Sharon McDonnell. She's an epidemiologist from Maine who volunteered to lend her skills to the fight against Ebola. McDonnell's currently based at a hospital in a poor neighborhood of Liberia's capital, Monrovia. And she says that despite improvements, it's still a crisis there.
We still have over 400 cases in the last 21 days, which gives you a sense of how desperate that would be in any other setting.
What's your average workday like?
Well, I get up. It's about 45 minutes in traffic down to the hospital. We have to go through the screening process with the patients, and it's quite, you stand in line and you wait and you get your temperature taken, you wash your hands, you get your feet sprayed. At this point, we've only been open maybe since the 12th of January. So this reestablishing services, it's everything from let's find an extension cord for the oxygen tank for the child in respiratory distress to can we get any sort of link for our media, our internet, can we, you know, just everything is sort of out there.
So this hospital is just trying to come back up to speed after really being forced to shut down because of Ebola. You've described what it's like for you as a healthcare worker. What about the patients?
For every Ebola case that's in the outbreak, there is a 10 times greater outbreak of non-Ebola disease that was completely unable to be seen because the health facilities in the entire city were closed.
What do you mean by non-Ebola healthcare?
It's everything else. It's women delivering babies, it's malaria, it's hypertension, it's heart attacks, it's typhoid, it's everything else that wasn't Ebola.
So the hospital, which is just getting back on its feet, is also trying to, it's dealing with Ebola, but then it's dealing with all these other things.
Well, and the big trick here is trying to discriminate between an Ebola case, which you want to really isolate from everybody else, and all the other people who have fever and, you know, runny noses and nausea and vomiting. Almost every child that comes to a health center in Africa has symptoms that sound exactly like Ebola. And trying to distinguish those and still give care to people who need it and separate those who have Ebola from non-Ebola is a huge undertaking.
Have you had any incidences where you really didn't know the what was going on and you sort of risked infecting people?
Well, we've had a few incidents. One of them was a young child that, as it turned out, had symptoms like nausea and vomiting. No history of contact as near as we could ascertain, came in at night, and then began to get sicker. And the staff is trying to sort of keep asking questions. Once somebody comes in, to sort of keep probing and gently asking questions, and sometimes more history will come out. And in this case, the fact that a family member had died and another family member was sick put everyone on alert. So then you have to sort of make the ward kind of contain that area. It's not ideal.
So the girl that you mentioned that came in, it turned out she had had contact with people with Ebola. Did then healthcare workers have to go into quarantine because of that? Because you didn't know when you admitted her?
At that point, we contained the child, and then everybody that had contact with her had to be put under quarantine. So we lost 7 of our staff for 21 days. So we can't take many more of those without decimating our staff.
Now, at the start of the Ebola crisis, there was a lot of distrust between healthcare workers and the public, a lot of members of the public fearing that they would actually die if they went to hospital instead of being treated, and you know this whole thing. And what's the level of that distrust now? Is there a better relationship with the community and more trust established?
Well, it varies around Monrovia. In our community, there has been a longstanding history of sort of mistrust of government services, certainly. Health workers are viewed as being harsh and perhaps not very kindly, like they were not treated in a respectful way. And the staff felt like these people are trying, you know, they're coming in and they're giving us Ebola, and they feel quite at risk about this. And it becomes very important for us that screening is as civilized, as kind, and as controlled as it can be, so that we're signaling to everybody that we're really trying to be careful.
Sharon McDonald is an epidemiologist from Maine. She's in Monrovia, Liberia, helping to fight the Ebola epidemic. Thanks so much, Sharon.
Thank you.
You can ask Sharon what it's like to work at a hospital where every patient has to be treated as a potential Ebola risk. She's joining us right now on our Facebook page to discuss her experiences in Liberia. Ask Sharon your questions at facebook.com/PRI the world. The so-called Islamic State has a sophisticated propaganda machine. Social media, religious sermons, even music, all are used to spread the group's extremist message. And of course, to recruit new fighters from the West. Not just young men, but women as well. The London-based Institute for Strategic Dialogue has a new study on how ISIS recruits women. It's called Becoming Mulan, Female Western Migrants to ISIS. I asked the Institute's Aaron Saltman to explain the title.
Well, within the first couple pages, we actually have a direct quotation from a female migrant. We don't call them foreign fighters because they're not actually fighting. And she, in this quote, talks about hoping or maybe fantasizing that she could pull a Mulan. And what that references is actually the fact it is the Disney movie reference, where she is in her position in Islamic State territory and is unable to fight because women there are only serving as more wives and mother roles. But the reference to "I hope I could pull a Mulan" really says she wishes she could cut off her hair, dress as a boy, and participate in the fighting, in the war and conflict that's going on. And it really shows not only the Western background of some of these women, as well as how young they are, still giving Disney references on their social media, but also their willingness and desire to participate in the more violent side of the conflict.
And what were the primary reasons you found that these women are going or migrating to Syria to join ISIS in some capacity?
There's definitely different things. The story is a little bit different for every woman, but there are definitely some overarching themes. And what we see is, in some ways, we shouldn't have an engendered approach to radicalization. These women hold very similar ideologies as their male counterparts, meaning that they are doing this. They believe that they are taking part in a humanitarian effort. They feel that they are a part of the state building of Islamic State. So they feel like they are participating in building a Muslim utopia for Islam. And there's also romantic elements where for a lot of these younger women, this is a sense of adventure. Many of them have never traveled by themselves. They've been recruited and told that they will be traveling to a faraway place where they will marry this romantic idea of a jihadist soldier out in the desert. And a lot of these romantic notions go quite a long way. And ISIS has been very good with their propaganda of continuing that idea.
What kind of things do they do? What is their life like when they enter ISIS territory?
It's quite restrictive. For many public spaces, they're not allowed to go out without a chaperone, a male chaperone, which restricts movement quite a lot for women. We're also dealing with a war zone, so there are electricity outages. We also have situations where Western women going out there, most of them do not speak the local language. They don't speak Arabic, so there are situations that can get quite awkward and even horrific where women needing medical attention are actually not seen to and don't know how to communicate. And there is a story we convey in the report where a woman is miscarriaging and not being treated because the doctors not only don't know how to communicate with her, but they are looking at these foreigners in a different way than they look at the locals.
Is there a case of a specific woman who was recruited to ISIS that stood out for you?
There's different stories that stick out, different tweets that stick out more than others. One in particular that I thought was interesting was a woman tweeting about how in the middle of the night she heard gunfire, and she was tweeting, live tweeting as she was hearing this. And then an hour later, she tweets again and says, "Oh, you know, it was nothing. It turns out we weren't there. But, you know, I thought it was an insurgency. And if it had been, I was reaching for my belt." And she was alluding to the fact that she had basically a suicide belt, a suicide vest. So it shows how these women are perhaps equipped. There is the potential for them. They've been trained that in the case of an emergency, they should carry out perhaps a suicide attack using themselves as a weapon.
Does ISIS then use these women to recruit more women? Do they become the person online who is talking to future recruits?
Definitely. In fact, the thing that separates ISIS from other terrorist and jihadist organizations is the fact that they have allowed so openly for this decentralized messaging for foreign fighters and these women to have access to Twitter accounts, to blogs. Other jihadist organizations have kept their messaging and media very restrictive, but we don't see that. And it offers a very insightful lens into the daily lives of these women, but it also gives them a tool for inciting violence, for others to take part. We also see women saying, you know, if you're not able to come and join us in this Islamic State, then carry out acts of terror at home. And that becomes worrisome because it's trying to export the threat.
Aaron Saltman is with the Institute for Strategic Dialogue in London. Let's talk now about one of the forces driving impressionable women and men into the arms of extremist groups like ISIS.
Just about every extremist insurgency we see in the world today is operating in an environment of acute corruption and puts forward the notion that the only way to achieve public integrity is by way of a kind of strict code of personal moral purity.
That's author Sarah Chase. She delves into how corrupt governments give rise to religious extremism in her new book, Thieves of State. Chase says the radical response to corruption isn't limited to Islam.
What I found really interesting when I was researching this book, which I didn't expect, is that there's a similar strain in the Christian tradition. So today in Nigeria, for example, there is a very powerful, very strict Pentecostal movement among Nigerian Christians, and they haven't quite said, go attack the government or go attack the police or go attack Muslims. But the amount of violence that I experienced in Sunday services that I attended was quite frightening. And the language that was used was all about corruption.
I want to stop you there just for a moment. When you say sort of violence in the Sunday services, what are you referring to?
Violent language. It's about the enemy. It's about the enemy has thwarted my destiny. And people would jump up and shake their fists. And the violence in the air, the powerful negative emotions that were being evoked and expressed. And we're talking big churches here. We're talking a couple thousand people. It was impressive.
Now, you spend a lot of time in your book on Afghanistan. And of course, it's a country that you yourself have spent years in. Describe the sort of living in a kind of a corrupt country. What are the things you encounter? What are the kind of the corruption you keep referring to people are really sick and tired of? What's it like?
So essentially every time you come into contact with a government official, not only do you have to fork over money, but they treat you, they demand it in an incredibly humiliating way. There's a story in the book about the brother of one of the members of my manufacturing cooperative who not only was shaken down by police five times between, you know, the border of Pakistan and Kandahar where we were living, which is about an hour and a half drive, but when he tried to balk, he actually got struck in the face. And when he tried to call somebody to report this, the police took his phone and broke it. There's an arrogance and a humiliating way in which these, quote, petty bribes are extorted by government officials. The choices that this ends up presenting ordinary people are three. One is, if they're ambitious, they usually become corrupt because that's really the only way to get ahead. If they're really outraged at this type of behavior on the part of the government, they tend to join an insurgent movement or a revolution, like in the Arab Spring. And everybody else are victims. There's like no space between being a victim and being a perpetrator.
But I think what's hard to square is that the groups that people have chosen to get involved with, whether it's ISIS or the Taliban or Boko Haram, there's not a lot of purity going on.
There isn't. And what I would suggest is you think back to our own revolution. People were being tarred and feathered in the streets. Look at the French Revolution and the torrents of blood that were spilled during that long event. I think that when humans are driven to extremes, they lose their sense of logic. And often they can then be captured and manipulated by individuals or groups that are exploiting legitimate grievances and then bend recruits to behaviors that are no more acceptable than the behavior of the government that they're revolting against.
In all your research, who have you come across or what country is doing something effective to fight corruption?
There is a growing, at least verbal recognition on the part of top U.S. government officials that this really is a problem that can no longer be relegated to a sort of back burner, that it is connected to some of the security crises that have been flaring up over the last couple of years, and that it may be important to start addressing really severe or structured corruption upstream of when it generates a really serious security crisis.
Sarah Chase is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment. Her new book is called Thieves of State: Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you, Carol.
And you're listening to The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings and legal plans featuring attorney contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Carol Hills with The World. Hawaii has long been the most diverse state in America. In fact, it's the only state never to have had a white majority. There are Native Hawaiians, of course, and other Pacific Islanders, plus members of several immigrant groups who've settled there over the years. Chinese, Japanese, Filipinos. But one group you probably don't think of when it comes to the Aloha State is Russians. Well, it turns out they also landed in Hawaii back in the days when it was an American territory. And as our friend Alina Simone found out, researchers at the University of Hawaii have recently put online a rare album that sheds light on this all but unknown wave of immigrants.
4 years ago, I went on a Hawaiian vacation. No, I didn't go snorkeling. I spent nearly all my time in the bowels of a university archive, browsing 100-year-old newspapers. The truth is, I can only stand so much sand and sea. And when I happened to type two words into Google, Russians and Hawaii, I stumbled across a startling historical footnote. At the turn of the last century, the Hawaiian Board of Immigration imported more than 1,500 Russians, mostly from Siberia, to work the island's sugar plantations in a last-ditch effort to make Hawaii more white.
They had brought in Asian labor at first, Chinese and Japanese laborers.
This is Patricia Polanski, Russian bibliographer at University of Hawaii's Hamilton Library. Asian labor was the backbone of the early sugar industry, but it was a brutal way to make a living. In 1909, several thousand Japanese laborers went on strike, demanding better pay and working conditions, which worried plantation owners.
So they decided they wanted to try what we call haole labor or white labor.
A report issued by the Commissioner of Labor on Hawaii described local planters as, quote, willing without reserve to employ all the Caucasian workers the government can bring to the islands at a wage one-third larger than what was paid Asian laborers.
And when the plantation owners were looking around for white groups, there happened to be in Honolulu a man named Peril Strauss, who was a Russian kind of entrepreneur.
Kind of is kind of the key here. Peril Strauss drew up a recruitment brochure for the Russians, and according to Amir Hizimudinov, historian at Far Eastern Federal University in Khabarovsk, once Peril Strauss and his crew reached Russia,
they always make huge, huge propaganda. You need to come, we're doing for you big possibilities to work, good weather.
There were all kinds of things in there. They would be given a little house, how many hours they had to work, what their wages would be.
Right. The brochure also suggested the Russians would be given their own land.
But that actually didn't turn out to be true, of course. They were coming just to work on the plantations. So that was part of what caused a lot of the trouble after the Russians got here.
After getting a taste of plantation life, the Russians went on strike. To better understand their rebellion, I drove out to Hawaii Plantation Village in Waipahu, an outdoor museum of plantation life. Even though it's only a few miles from the beach, Waipahu is nothing like the Azure Coast. And when I touched an actual sugarcane plant, it felt more like a weapon than food. The Siberians probably imagined they were traveling to an island paradise. Instead, they ended up in quarantine after measles broke out on their steamer. Their encampment on a Honolulu wharf became a tourist draw, while the newspapers made a circus out of the immigration snafu. According to Amir Hizimudinov, a large part of this was due to communication failure.
Language, it was really huge problem, very huge problem for Russians in Hawaii. They don't have interpreters.
There were so few Russian speakers in Hawaii, they recruited a local actress to help negotiate disputes, like one that broke out when the Russians tried bathing in the nude on a public beach. And there wasn't much cultural interpretation. Everything in Hawaii was totally alien to the Russians, from the local cuisine to the tropical weather. And there was no community hub, no church, no expat ambassadors to help explain
what they must be doing, what their obligations, what they may for children, for education. I think it's the biggest mistake from authorities in Hawaii. They didn't describe.
The Russians fled Hawaii in droves, many headed for California or New York. A few returned to Russia. But the story has another twist. Several years after the Russians first arrived in Hawaii, the Russian Revolution took place. That was 1917. And the new government, headed by Vladimir Lenin, wanted the Russians in Hawaii to come back home.
So Moscow sent a man here whose name was Trautsholt. And his job, he had money. He was to pay their passage back to Russia. And he was to fill out their passport applications and everything. And that's what this album is that we have. We have the passport application album.
What Patricia Polanski is talking about here is a kind of scrapbook that Trautsholt compiled, filled with portraits and biographical sketches of the Russians who remained. It's an extraordinary document, probably the only place you'll find photos of Russian men with handlebar mustaches, wearing Hawaiian work clothes. Few people took Trautsholt up on his offer of free passage to war-torn communist Russia, but some who did never forgot Hawaii. Fast forward several decades to the collapse of the Soviet Union and...
One day I had a phone call from Catholic Charities, and they said, oh, there's a Russian woman here. I met her, and she was carrying an urn with her that had her mother's ashes in it. And it happened to be that her mother was born here in Hawaii. She was a child of one of these people that came here to work on the plantations. But her family had decided to repatriate to Soviet Union.
When her mother was on her deathbed, she told her daughter, I want to be buried in Hawaii. With the Iron Curtain firmly in place, that didn't seem likely. So she waited.
And the minute the Soviet Union collapsed, she put herself on an airplane and showed up in Hawaii with her mother's ashes.
Not all their encounters with descendants have been this dramatic, of course, but once Patricia and Amir put the Russian passport album online, they began to connect even more families with the long-lost Russians of Hawaii.
We have been contacted by, I'd say, maybe 30 people that are descendants of people listed in the album.
It's funny to think what Hawaii might look like had the Russian immigration scheme succeeded. Would the islands be dotted with borscht stands today? Would balalaika jam bands be performing at the annual Island Arts Festival? These are questions you can spend an entire tropical vacation contemplating. But given this is a place where you can find sushi made from spam, I doubt there's any influence Hawaii can't absorb. For the world, this is Alina Simone.
Yes, that is the Russian national anthem being played on a ukulele, courtesy of Bruce Spiegelmeier. You can see photos from that Russian passport application album at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for being with us.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by the Ford Foundation, by PRI's New Voices Fund, whose donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers, and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation, and by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at carnegie.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.